Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The Comb is all about people, and it's all about surprising stories. It's all about finding out what's really going on, and it's all about Africa. It's a brand new podcast from the BBC World Service, and you can find it by searching for The Comb, wherever you got this podcast.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 13 hours GMT on Monday the 6th of July, these are our main stories. China has accused Britain of gross interference in its internal affairs as tensions over the future of Hong Kong sour relations. The man behind one of the world's largest child porn websites is freed from jail in South Korea, and the robot scientist which could increase the pace of new scientific discoveries. Also in this podcast.
We receive a lot of reports of people being sick, of people who are now treated in hospitals with symptoms looking like this could be a COVID-19.
A World Health Organization team arrives in Turkmenistan to investigate why not a single case of COVID-19 has been reported there. And the Oscar-winning Italian composer Ennio Morricone has died at the age of 91. The world has to stand with Hong Kong. That's the message from the young activist Joshua Wong, appearing in court on charges of illegal assembly. It comes after China pushed through its controversial new security law, meaning some could face punishments up to life in prison. The law targets secession, subversion and terrorism, and after protests against it, the arrests and charges under that law quickly followed. While others have fled Hong Kong, Mr. Wong vowed to stay and says he'll never surrender.
We still hope to encourage more people continue to engage in the democracy movement. Even they ban my book in public library, they can't ignore and silence the voice of Hong Kong people. With the belief of Hong Kong people to fight for freedom, we will never give up and surrender to Beijing.
Our correspondent in Beijing is Stephen McDonnell.
He and other senior members of, well, the now defunct Democisto party are appearing in court. Now, they're facing charges not under the new state security law, but relating to matters from last year. So it's sort of still proceeding through the courts. They're being accused of inciting others to take part in an unauthorised assembly. So there he is with other leaders from Democisto standing up outside the court. But, you know, it's interesting. One of the other founders of that party, Nathan Law, has already fled Hong Kong. Possibly Joshua Wong and others couldn't leave because they were facing these charges. But, you know, their party, for example, has now been disbanded. They all sort of stood down, saying that under the new law it was too dangerous. And even though they've done this, they're saying they're going to find other ways to try and resist the worst aspects of this new law and, you know, the worst excesses of the government there in Hong Kong, and somehow or other still bring about the democratic reforms they so crave.
What can you tell us about the professor who's been arrested today in Beijing?
Yeah, well, on the same day that Joshua Wong's appearing in Beijing, a professor, Chu Zhengrun, was picked up in Beijing. Now, his friends are saying that this critic of the government, vocal critic of the government, was taken away by some 20 officers, came to his home. Now, he has become a sort of rare, outspoken critic in sort of academic circles here. He's a legal scholar from Tsinghua University. And apart from criticising the government recently on its handling of the coronavirus, I mean, for example, he's gone so far as to say that, you know, the party has reintroduced a sort of cult of personality not seen since the Mao era with Xi Jinping's leadership. And he became famous for criticising these changes that were brought in to allow Xi Jinping to effectively remain chairman for life. So even though he'd been making these controversial comments and he's sort of threatened by the authorities with various periods of house arrest, if you keep doing this, you're going to get into more trouble, he has kept speaking out, as I say, most recently, criticising the government for not allowing factual information to be released relating to the coronavirus. And he's been now taken away. Now, we haven't heard from the police in terms of any sort of a official indication of what he's to be charged with or what he's accused of, but that can take a long time in China.
Later, China's ambassador to Britain, Liu Xiaoming, defended the national security law. Speaking at a virtual news conference, he said Hong Kong had been left defenceless against anti-Chinese forces, and he accused pro-democracy protesters of making the national security law necessary.
They even cried for waging armed revolution to gain independence. Such activities trampled on the rule of law, undermined social stability, hit the economy hard, and put the national security at a serious risk.
The ambassador also warned that Britain is in danger of turning his country into a hostile state and will bear the consequences if it does so. He said China wanted a partnership. Relations between the two sides have deteriorated over Hong Kong, and reports the UK could phase out equipment made by the Chinese company Huawei from the new 5G networks. Our World Affairs correspondent is Paul Adams.
The Chinese ambassador said any decision to shut Huawei out of the UK's 5G infrastructure would tarnish Britain's reputation. Britain could not be great, he said, if it could not make its own foreign policy, a reference to the role of US pressure in the government's rethink. Last week, Boris Johnson said he wanted to see the UK's critical national infrastructure protected from what he called hostile state vendors. Ambassador Liu said it was a mistake to treat China like an enemy. Chinese officials, he said, had never described Britain this way. He insisted Huawei still represented a win-win solution for both countries. But if the UK was willing to pay more for inferior technology, he said, then that was a decision for the British government. With customers in 169 other countries, he said, Huawei would survive and prosper.
Paul Adams. A South Korean court has denied an extradition request by the United States for a man who ran one of the world's largest known child pornography websites. Song Yong-woo will now be released from prison. He was rearrested in April following a warrant for his extradition after he'd served 18 months in jail for producing and distributing child pornography. Our Seoul correspondent is Laura Bicker.
He ran the Welcome to Video site. Now, this was a kind of covert den where people could swap videos of child pornography, sexual abuse of children, and they found the man that they believe was operating this all, and that is Son Jong-woo. Now, he was tried in South Korea and sentenced to child pornography and distribution charges, where he spent 18 months, as you say, in prison. The US issued a warrant. They wanted him extradited. So he was released in April and then rearrested in the hope, US authorities hoped certainly, that he would be extradited. But today, in the third extradition hearing, the High Court here in Seoul, I'm in center of Seoul right now, they have decided that he will not be extradited. This is quite an unusual decision. I can only find six cases where they've not been extradited. But the High Court judges decided that it would be better that he stayed in the country to help them fight this sort of crime. But it will be a very controversial decision. There were campaigners outside the court just before the extradition hearing calling for him to be sent to the US because they believe he would be given a harsher sentence, maybe up to 20 years there.
Laura Bicker. To Australia now, which has overall fared extremely well in the battle against coronavirus. Just a few weeks ago, the country was almost COVID-free, and overall only around 100 people had died from the disease. But now an outbreak of infections in the eastern state of Victoria has caused the two most populous states, Victoria and New South Wales, to shut their joint border. The authorities in Melbourne have also placed 9 public housing estates, home to nearly 3,000 residents, in lockdown. Our correspondent in Sydney, Shaima Khalil, told me more.
I guess it just shows the level of anxiety and concern among leaders that the spike that's happening in Victoria's capital city, in Melbourne, could spill over here in New South Wales. So despite the Prime Minister and the New South Wales Premier playing that scenario down, saying that a closure wouldn't be necessary, with the critical situation that Victoria finds itself in, now it's deemed the right thing to do. Of course, there'll be the inevitable economic impact, but I think logistics are also a big challenge here. There are 50 border crossings between those two states. Towns around the border share that border as well.
And then officials in Melbourne have placed 9 public housing estates with 3,000 residents in complete lockdown. A lot of police actually in attendance there. Just take a listen to this clip of one of the residents.
I heard sirens outside, and when I looked down, there was about 50 police cars just parked under our building, closing all the streets and every entrance and exit. But when there's that much police presence, you begin to feel like you did something wrong. So it wasn't a safe feeling. There was no health representatives present at the time. People believe that these buildings are full of immigrants and people that just lower class, and they don't treat them as normal citizens.
So, Shaima, it sounds like real anger there.
There is real anger, and I would say that this sentiment has been echoed by so many people, so many residents that have been speaking to local media all through the day. Imagine that on Saturday, police forces just showed up at these people's doorsteps, and all of a sudden, they found themselves in full lockdown. No one in, no one out. No one out even to get food for their children, formula for babies. And so all of a sudden, people just felt, well, what did we do wrong? Contrast that to what's been happening to, a partial lockdown to some of the areas and the suburbs down the street from them, where people have been advised to stay at home, but they could go out for work, they could go out to buy their necessities, they could go out for a walk. So there's a real contrast in how those two cases have been treated. However, I would say that the authorities have described, though, the 9 tower blocks as vertical cruise ships, if you will. They said with the cluster of about 30 people or so within those towers, the possibility of hundreds of people coming into contact with them, which means they are in an incubation period, is very, very high. And that could have an explosive potential on the spread of COVID-19.
Shaima Khalil in Sydney. Experts from the World Health Organization have arrived in Turkmenistan in Central Asia to investigate why not a single case of coronavirus has been reported there, despite the country bordering Iran, where officially almost 250,000 people have been infected. But independent media reports claim there's been a surge in cases of acute pneumonia in Turkmenistan, which is one of the most secretive states in the world. Our Central Asia correspondent Rehan Dimitri reports.
News bulletins on Turkmen State TV do not report on coronavirus because officially not a single case of COVID-19 has been registered here. Now the World Health Organization will have a chance to assess whether that really is the case. After weeks of waiting, a team of medical experts has finally been allowed into the country. Dr. Catherine Smallwood is leading the team.
Yes, we would have very much liked to have gone earlier. So indeed, end of May was when we initially talked about going and when we had the initial discussions with the government of Turkmenistan and the invitation to travel there. However, the logistics issues have been the main issue hampering our movement. And during our mission, we will be visiting healthcare facilities, including major referral hospitals. We'll also be visiting primary healthcare centres, laboratories, quarantine centres, border crossings.
Turkmenistan closed its borders back in February and quarantined people entering the country. Information about how effective these measures have been is limited. Independent media reports suggest that coronavirus has indeed reached the country and is spreading fast. Ruslan Tukhbatulin runs the Chronicles of Turkmenistan news website from Europe.
Now we receive a lot of reports of people being sick, of people who are now treated in hospitals with symptoms looking like this could be a COVID-19. And more and more independent news sources report of these, well, cases of death of people and cases when the whole hospitals are being closed for quarantine with people and with doctors inside the hospitals who cannot leave the hospital.
Amnesty International describes Turkmenistan as one of the most authoritarian countries in the world. Its president, Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov, has built a cult of personality. He's often seen on state television giving orders and reprimanding his officials. They all dutifully take notes as he speaks. The government paints a picture of stability and prosperity, but independent reports show a different reality. A collapsing economy, queues for food, and now denial about the virus.
Rayhan Dimitri. Still to come in this podcast. The death of Ennio Morricone, composer of some of the best-known film scores of all time. A Russian journalist has been found guilty of justifying terrorism for an article she wrote about a bomb attack on a regional office of the FSB security service. Svetlana Prokopyeva argued that the teenage bomber who died in the attack, which also injured three FSB officers, could have been motivated by despair at Russia's repressive state system. She described the criminal case against her as a murderous blow against free speech. Prosecutors wanted the journalist sentenced to 6 years in prison, but in a surprise and unusual move, she's been fined 500,000 rubles, or just under $7,000. Our Moscow correspondent Sarah Rainsford reports.
Svetlana Prokopyeva's original article was hard-hitting and controversial, but Russian prosecutors decided it was criminal. They wanted the journalist sent to prison, insisting that her discussion of an attack on an FSB security service building had justified and romanticized the actions of the teenage bomber. Svetlana Prokopyeva had argued that the 17-year-old might have been driven by despair, radicalized by growing up in a repressive state where protests are quashed and where, she argued, cruelty breeds cruelty. Her prosecution was widely criticized as political and an attack on free speech. The journalist appeared in court for the verdict in a T-shirt that read, "We won't be silenced." Commenting on her case today, the Kremlin spokesman said it was not about freedom, but certain nuances, as he put it, linked to the laws on terrorism. The decision to fine Svetlana Prokopyeva, not to hand her a prison sentence, is highly unusual for Russia. But human rights groups warn that the guilty verdict sets a dangerous precedent for the press. The journalist will also remain on a national register of terrorists and extremists.
Sarah Rainsford in Moscow. While lockdown has meant that scientists around the world have had to leave their labs for the safety of home, one researcher has stayed put, working around the clock. Our science correspondent Victoria Gill has been finding out more.
While PhD student and chemist Benjamin Bucher has been locked down at home, an experiment he designed has been operated by a robotic colleague.
And this robot is able to work autonomously on its own. And then this way I can run experiments from my desk anywhere.
Ben can send his instructions from his laptop to the robot. And he can even see what it's doing through cameras all over the lab.
There are lab benches all around and there are fume cupboards, racks of glassware. But there are no humans working here, just this one robotic scientist, which looks pretty busy. It's a large box on small wheels, and it has an impressive-looking robotic arm that's currently placing racks of tiny glass vials into a big incubator.
Tell me what's novel about this particular robot.
The robot works 24/7, so this allows me to start an experiment in the morning, come back 3 days later while the AI is running the experiment. I would not be able to do this by hand because it would easily go to thousands of samples.
In the age of social distancing, this £100,000 robotic scientist, developed by Andy Cooper at the University of Liverpool, has taken on a whole new role.
Supermarkets use robots to sort your groceries, cars are made using robots. But this robot actually uses artificial intelligence to make decisions about what it does. So it does experiments, it collects data, and then it decides what to do next. So in that sense, it works like a scientist rather than a simple piece of automation.
This is a tremendous new age for scientists.
According to Dr. Deirdre Black from the Royal Society of Chemistry, robotics is just one element of a digital revolution that will keep scientific discovery moving as quickly as possible, even though far fewer scientists will be able to get back into their labs.
So could these machines do all of the science?
Absolutely not. This is about human beings harnessing all of these digital technologies so that they can explore bigger and tackle much more complex problems like decarbonisation, preventing and treating disease, making the quality of our air cleaner. But we'll always need people.
Professor Cooper thinks technology like this could help scientists around the world to work together on some of the biggest challenges facing society.
Climate change, COVID. So our vision is we might have robots like this all across the world. They're connected by a centralised brain, which can be anywhere. We haven't done that yet. This is the first example, but that's absolutely what we'd like to do.
For now, and as long as the power remains on, this particular scientist will keep on working so the human scientists can run their experiments from home.
Victoria Gill. The African-American poet Caroline Randall Williams has penned an essay for the New York Times titled, "You Want a Confederate Monument? My Body Is a Confederate Monument." It's specifically about rape, the rape of her ancestors by their slave owner, and puts black southerners like her squarely at the heart of the recent debate about statues and their possible removal. The BBC's Claire McDonald caught up with Caroline Randall Williams. She started by reading an extract from the article.
"I have rape-coloured skin. My light brown blackness is a living testament to the rules, the practices, the causes of the Old South. My body is a monument."
A hugely arresting piece. Your history then, tell us what happened.
You know, my story is just not an unusual one. You know, most people who have ancestors in the United States who were enslaved have some meaningful percentage of European blood, because this was a function of American chattel slavery. Women were taken advantage of. Black women were taken advantage of by the white men for whom they worked, by whom they were owned. And that is a story that people like to sort of sweep under the rug, but it's a story that my skin tells quite plainly. It shouldn't be a source of black people's shame. It should be a source of shame for the people who try to perpetuate the lie.
It's the whole story, in other words. You say mainly it swept under the rug. Was it in your family?
It's not something that you boast about in any meaningful way, because, you know, all of these people I'm discussing were people that still had to sit in the back of buses and drink out of the colored water fountains and attend colored schools and colored colleges and navigate the various indignities of Jim Crow and segregation in this country. Blackness is a cultural identity, not a genetic one. I did know about those people in my family, and, you know, you can look at me and tell that there must be Europe in there.
And Pettus, you go on to say, he's the Confederate general, the grand dragon of the Ku Klux Klan. These kind of monuments you would have had to live with, walk past, I guess, on the way to school, because you grew up in the South. What did you think about these statues?
I'd walk by the statues and I'd think, these people have so much pride in these people. And I'm thinking, I know I'm related to these people, and I'm related to them because they were awful. So I sort of thought the joke was on the people that celebrated the statues.
The argument runs, though, that we have to learn from the past to not repeat the mistakes of history. What do you say to that argument?
Most of the monuments, some majority of them in this country, were actually erected during Jim Crow and during the civil rights movement as means of intimidating black people who were beginning to become restive and want to exercise the powers that the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments had ostensibly given them at the end of the Civil War. These are not monuments to just remember what had happened in real time, first of all. And second of all, I think, to me, it's like asking if Germans should leave up statues of Hitler or Goring or, I mean, any of the, or Himmler or Mengele. It's like, why? These were people who committed egregious crimes against humanity or sought to uphold a system that was in and of, like, functionally a continued egregious crime against humanity. We don't honor those people by leaving up statues that might have been erected by the misguided people who followed them. We put them in history books and we put them in Holocaust museums, and we make the places where they committed their crimes into places of serious and earnest learning. We don't leave up statues and remember that, oh, once we thought they were right.
Poet Caroline Randall Williams speaking to Claire McDonnell. Ennio Morricone, the Italian composer whose haunting music graced hundreds of films over a 50-year career, has died at the age of 91. He composed and arranged scores for more than 500 film and television productions, including A Fistful of Dollars, The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, and The Mission. Lawrence Pollard looks back at his life.
Wherever the news of Ennio Morricone's death is being reported, you'll be hearing this. Or this. Or this. Or others of his instantly recognisable themes for the 1960s Italian westerns, like The Good, the Bad and the Ugly and A Fistful of Dollars. Films he emphatically would not have called spaghetti westerns, and which he made with his former school friend Sergio Leone. Morricone was born in Rome, the son of a jazz trumpeter, and was rigorously trained in classical composition. His initial enthusiasm was for avant-garde classical music, but the need to make a living led him into commercial work, playing jazz trumpet, arranging pop songs, and writing a couple of early movie scores. Then he was hired by Leone for A Fistful of Dollars in 1964, a film score that broke the mold. This was far from the normal music of a traditional Hollywood Western. Instead of a lush, full orchestra, Morricone used a small band of players, electric guitar, mouth organ, and the now famous found sounds like gunshots, whips, wailing voices, and whistles.
I can't really remember where the whistling idea came from, but Sergio liked it. And he decided to use it in A Fistful of Dollars, and then he wanted it in the second movie as well. And by the third one, I had to say, that's enough now. I'm done with the whistling. No more. So when we did The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, we used the coyote howl instead.
Morricone worked with the same team of musicians on many other movies, for example, scoring 20 films in 1968 alone. During his career, he produced a staggering amount of work, between 500 and 600 scores. Throughout his life, Morricone talked about the universal appeal of music and the way that it was not just an add-on to a film, but an integral part of telling the story.
Music has its own flexibility. What I mean by this is that it adapts to the cultural sensibilities of the listener. Each listener brings his own ear to a piece of music, so it is interpreted in many different ways. What I look for as a composer for cinema is the underlying story in a film. A story that cannot be told through images or through dialogue.
Lawrence Pollard reporting. And one other life fact about Ennio Morricone: he never left Rome to compose his music and never learned to speak English. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
This is The Comb.
Ye ni the comb.
The comb, no.
Ni the comb.
The comb.
The Comb is all about digging deep into one single African story every week.
This is like a moment. This is a day for you to celebrate.
Stories that might otherwise go underneath the radar, that might otherwise be overlooked.
You're in a hurry to get money. You just click OK and that one button lands you into trouble.
Stories about Africa and stories that matter.
I would walk into a bank for my salary only to be told that I should come back tomorrow because there's no money in the bank. So I decided just to quit. I quit.
I hope people will feel the way that I sometimes feel, where you are surprised and you come away kind of like, oh, I really didn't know that.
Why would anybody kill somebody over sand? What on earth would make sand so valuable?
That's The Comb from the BBC World Service. Just search for The Comb wherever you get your podcasts.